This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
And welcome to The Blank Podcast, a podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and navigating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Charles Perry Phillips, and a very, very tired and sleepy co-host, Jim Daly.
Good timing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I can see the problem with doing Zoom pods is you can see yourself in the camera.
Yes.
And I look like a shell of a man.
Oh, well, mate, you've had a few difficult evenings with your young kiddles.
Kiddles? Sounds like a character from a Pixar movie. Yes. Also, the angle of my laptop, because I'm not in the cabin, just why my audio is slightly different. This angle gives me at least two, if not three, chins.
Nah, depending on. It's just.
There's a lot of chins going on there.
Wow. I think you're doing yourself a disservice.
You've got a good angle. Yours is a higher angle.
Well, I've got a microphone in the way as well.
that's the way to do it. Maybe I should hold my phone here.
Yeah, that's much better. Much better.
Anyway, how are you doing? You were just telling us off air, and I've made us start recording about your cheesy weekend.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, friend of the pod and one of my best friends, Sophie Green, came over on Friday to watch a movie, and last time she came over, I cooked her these roasted camemberts. And so I said, well, should I do it again? You know, because I don't know if she'll listen to this, but I did make her, what's that Spanish dish?
Paella.
Paella. Thank you, Jim.
That's literally the only Spanish dish I can think of.
I know. I made this paella, and it wasn't my best paella effort. It wasn't quite, it was a little bit, I think I overcooked the rice a little bit. So it wasn't my best. So I was a bit disappointed with
Welcome
that.
To middle class cooking.
Yeah. And then, so I thought I'll go back to a trusted friend in the roasted camembert. Yeah. So I should caveat this with the fact that when I did my online shop this week, which is also a very middle class thing to do, I ordered two camemberts because I thought, well, you know, we'll probably get through a couple of those. And I was getting them out of the bags, and I got a third one. And I thought,
I thought, no problem here. I'll polish this one off as well. Somehow.
Yeah, no problem. Then when I got to the last bag, the last item I pulled out was a fourth camembert.
You thought, I camembert this.
I camembert this situation. I actually took one of the camemberts to the coffee shop in the morning and gave one away because I was like, because unfortunately camembert is quite a potent cheese and it's rather honky.
Your fridge be stinking.
Mate, it fucking reeked.
Can I, like, without taking away any of your cooking abilities, and I know that you are very good in the kitchen when it comes to that, but baked camembert surely is just, you put camembert in the oven for an hour. I can't imagine there's much more to it. Well, even I could do that.
Well, I do add some garlic and rosemary to it. So, And you've got to get the timings right. I mean, you can ruin it, or you can underplay it, or you can.
How long is a good?
About 20 minutes.
What temperature?
About 20 minutes.
What temperature we're talking?
About 180 in a fan oven.
We really have to. People have switched off at this point.
This isn't the end of the story. So we had that, and that was a lot of cheese, right? A lot of cheese on a Friday night, and I ate quite a lot of chocolate as well. I ate lots of dairy. Anyway, the following evening, my wife Michelle's got some friends over, and I said, well, look, because I've been telling her ages to have some mates over for food. I'll look after you. I'll sort out like drinks, and I'll be like a waiter. I even put a shirt and tie on. And I had I thought I'd put all the things. So I invited them in. I took their coats and their bags, and I I poured them all a glass of wine, and you know, we set it all up, and I helped Shell set up the table and blah blah blah. Anyway, I got chat. So I was thinking, I'll just.
You are such a good husband. You're like the immaculate. I'd be like in the cabin playing Mega Drive. I wouldn't be anywhere near any of it. Where's Jim? Oh, he's playing Sonic again.
Well, I thought, you know, I wanted to treat Shell to, like, you know.
Really nice.
Well, yeah. So we, anyway, cut long story short, I thought I was going to eat some dinner and I was going to go and leave them to it, kind of thing. Like, let them have an evening and they can have some, like, some female chat. Anyway, I ended up chatting to the two guests.
Female chat?
Well, I don't know.
I don't even want to ask.
Slagging off their husbands, maybe. I don't know.
Not you, though.
Not me. He's great.
All the other women would be like, why isn't my husband like Joel greeting people with a glass of wine at the door?
We got talking and stuff. And then by the time I was about to go, Shell said, I've laid you a plate. I've laid you a place at the table. So I ended up staying and helping them eat. And we, mate, this was like fondue we had. So fondue. So this is like, it was unbelievable. There was over, I think if we work out the cheese weightage, it was probably about 800 grams of cheese was melted with white wine and this a proper old school 70s fondue set, which Michelle found in the charity shop. Fantastic. Amazing. And we were dipping everything in it. I mean, there was like nothing in our cupboards or fridge was was allowed to survive without having cheese put all over it. And then we didn't go to bed that late. It was about midnight, I suppose. Honestly, I couldn't wake up this morning. I felt like I was in some sort of cheese coma. I couldn't get out of bed. And then all day I've been wandering around in this sort of weird cheese haze.
It's a thing, isn't it? I do think that is a thing. I mean, it's probably just complete dairy overload.
Yeah.
But I have heard about sort of cheese days, yeah.
Mm.
So, but I'm not surprised, the amount of cheese you've had.
Well, so much cheese. And then I was on the sofa just before dinner, bearing in mind we had lasagna, which had loads of cheese in it as well. I think I was hallucinating because there was all sorts of weird stuff going on in the room, which I'm sure wasn't happening. So I think it's also led to psychosis now.
Right. And probably some weird dreams tonight, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's it, because they say about cheese having weird dreams. So I think I was possibly drifting off to sleep on the sofa.
Yeah.
Columbo was on. He was doing all sorts of shit.
Well, he does anyway.
Yeah.
It's on brand for him.
Yeah, but I mean, he wasn't just smoking his regular cigars. He was tripping his nuts off.
So are you having a break from cheese then?
I need to have a break from cheese. No more cheese today. I mean, or probably the rest of the week or month even.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's fascinating 8 minutes of interesting stuff.
I've been trying to think of a cheese segue into our guest. I can't think of one. I don't know how we can go from that story into... So this week's guest...
Yeah, I know. There's nothing cheesy about him.
No, there really isn't. No. Probably one of the coolest guys we've ever had on the podcast. But thank you for sharing that. Do you feel lighter? Probably not, actually, with all that cheese.
No, I feel about 3 stone heavier.
I do like cheese, though.
Well, it does make things better, I think. It makes the world better.
It's so nice.
Now, interestingly, Jim, because I'm going to ask you, because obviously you're vegetarian, and I would say maybe, are you borderline vegan these days?
We are vegetarian, and I'd say we end up eating probably about 50% of our meals are vegan, just by sort of default.
Yeah.
Really.
So what about cheese, though? Because obviously, yeah.
I do like cheese. I would struggle. I will say, I think vegan cheeses have got a lot better in the last few years.
Yeah.
I did try and being vegan for about 6 weeks in 2015. And it was really hard.
Yeah,
And that's only 8 years ago. There wasn't a lot of options. And I tried to make a toasted cheese sandwich with vegan cheese and I nearly burnt the house down. It did not melt. It was like plastic.
Yeah, that's...
But I'd imagine... I think now the options are a lot better. So, I think it's doable. Maybe I should... I reckon, give me another 5 years, I think I'll be more than 50%. I think I'll be closer to 80%.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Vegan. But I think actually, I think people in general will. I think the country will.
Yeah.
There's loads of people are now switching off to a more vegan plant-based lifestyle because the options are so good, and I think they'll only be better. I'm asking like a politician, aren't I? Sorry, that's a very serious answer. You are. But
we should probably talk about our brilliant guest this week.
Yeah, go on. Again, terrible. No segue possible.
Yeah, I know. Well, we had Andrew Gower on, who's an amazing actor and musician as well. He's been playing in bands for years, and obviously he's got a band now that he plays in. And he's been in all sorts of great shows like Outlander, Carnival Row, and I mean, I'm sure he's popped up in lots of different things. But yeah, what a great chat it was.
Well, another show that I slagged off halfway through the pod.
You got to be careful what you say.
Which everyone's feeding. What a guy. Mm. Massive track record. Just a lovely guy to talk to. Some really nice stuff. I mean, you know, when we get these guests come on, they're all so good at sort of segueing into life lessons and stuff. And he was just absolutely brilliant. But also, I'd say about 40% of the podcast is football. Maybe
not that 30%.
And I loved it.
Yeah.
I even managed... And our regular listeners will know, of course, how much I try and crowbar football in football life analogies and comparisons with acting. And Andrew agreed.
Yeah.
So it's not even like it wasn't even crowbarred this week. It was just like seamlessly linked in. So this week took so many boxes.
Well, yeah, if you like acting.
And I had to cut it early.
And you like football. Yeah, and you had to go off early, didn't you? Because you had some work to do.
So I apologise now to our listeners and to Andrew, but I had a work meeting to sort of go to, but we could have chatted to him.
Oh, for ages.
For hours.
We filled up the time of all my cheese talk anyway.
We're going to hit the hour mark on this one. Easy, that's fine. Oh, man, what a guy. We should probably go into it because I think as an intro, that's probably quite long. We've been a bit unfair to Andrew there, not really picked him up enough because we've spoken too much about cheese, but I would say he doesn't need it really because I think I was about to say he bigs himself up. That's wrong. But his genius talks to himself.
Yeah.
What am I talking about? I feel sleep deprived. I'm talking rubbish. You've got a cheese coma. I've had no sleep last few days. What is this intro? Andrew, I'm so sorry.
But what I was going to say was before we go into the pod is there was so many, I often write notes down when we're talking, but there was loads and loads that because we do our little audiograms that would go out on social media, but there was loads of Andrew. So it's a real treat this podcast, this episode, because there's loads of little takeaways that I think everyone will resonate with.
Definitely. I think we should just introduce him. So if it's okay with you, I'm gonna do the honors. Okay, I think that's a yes. This is the one and only Andrew. Sorry, Andrew. This is appalling, isn't it? I'm so sorry. Let me start again. This is, and leave this bit in. This is, because everyone loves the... Anyway.
They love the fuck-ups.
Sorry. I think Andrew would, actually. I think he'd love this. Anyway, by this point, he's just fast-forwarded it. Yeah. Everyone has. This is the one and only Andrew Gower on the Blank Podcast.
So they seem to be leaning towards Mr. Sean Dyche.
Well, this is what I thought would happen, to be honest. a safe pair of hands. The new Sam Allardyce.
the new big Sam. Honestly, to think in 2 years Everton have gone from Carlo Ancelotti.
Yeah. So that's interesting because I was going to ask you, because obviously you're from Merseyside, what side of the divide you would be on. So you're a blue.
My family's two on two. So my dad's a red. My eldest brother is a blue. My middle brother's a red and I'm a blue. And my poor mother just kind of is terrorized on Derby days. Yeah.
How did that happen then? How did, because surely your dad would have been disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, very well put. He was disappointed and still is. My eldest brother, basically, he's 10 years older than me. In my family, predominantly my extended family, it's blue. It's all blue. My dad's a rarity in my extended family. So it was basically me with my elder brother, just idolizing him being 10 years older, you know, hearing about Kevin Sheedy and Kevin Ratcliffe and, you know, the Everton of the 80s. Little did I know that,
you know, that was shortly.
That was it.
I'll never experience, you know, apart from pre-season cups and Paul Rideout, the memory of Paul Rideout in 95, that's it. And I was too young.
Daniel Amakachi,
yeah. What a performance at Tottenham Hotspur, yeah.
So you're talking to two Crystal Palace fans who ironically's only cup success was against Everton in the Zenith Data Systems.
The one they all wanted.
The one that I think probably stopped occurring after that win.
They all wanted. Everybody wanted it. Everybody wanted it.
Oh, this is lovely because obviously people that listen to this every week, this podcast, will know that Jim is always trying to segue in football references because he does a football podcast. So this is nice that we've started early doors on the football chat. Were you able to go to games when you were younger?
I was, yeah. So my mum's husband is an Evertonian, and he had season tickets. When my mum and dad separated, one of the things that I asked for was a stepfather who supported Everton. No, that was just a chance. But a great, great that he had a season ticket in Lower Bolands, and basically nice way to get to know him under the Moyes era. Which was actually, looking back, a cracking era for Everton.
Yeah, great time.
11 years of him as manager. So we were, every other Saturday or Sunday or midweek in Europe. We used to play in Europe. I was watching Everton with him. From behind the. I don't know. Have you guys been to Goodison Park?
I haven't. Have you, Jim?
Been a few times. It's a great ground. I mean, there aren't many sort of decent grounds left in the Premier League, but it's definitely up there. Although obviously it's not around for too much longer.
No, which is we might have the best stadium in the Championship.
That's looking up.
Yeah, I know. The part of the stadium I used to sit in was with the obstructed views. I think we got cheaper tickets, but
at Selhurst, I got a season ticket, and I didn't realize it was. I must be paying less than other people. It doesn't feel like it, but amazingly, my seat, you've got a restricted view for both goals. I got pole in the way for the Hopesdale goal, and actually, if I look left, I only realized the other day I have to go around the corner for the pole for the White Horse. So, but to be honest, for the last how long I've had it, 10, 15 years, a lot of that time was great because I didn't want to watch the action on the pitch anyway. So,
exactly, yeah. Well, so, we have very similar views, very similar views, very, yeah.
Well, I hope you are.
Everton stay. I mean, I like them, I think they're more successful than Palace traditionally, but I think in terms of fan base and culture and everything, really, I think we're very similar clubs.
I totally agree. And I always remember Palace from memories of stealing Andy Johnson off you guys. But always a great fixture. I make a point when I'm in, now I live in London, to go to a lot of the away fixtures. So I've been to Palace, Selhurst Park, and again, just a similar vibe to the stadium, and you know the fans, and it always says a lot, you know. And I love non-league football as well, but it always says a lot with fans that haven't. I quite like talking to fans of football teams who haven't experienced success as the other teams we don't like to speak of, but that. Palace really strikes me as that type of club.
Oh yeah, it's definitely one you can talk to about not having any success.
I've supported them for 30 years and I don't think I've seen us win anything. No, in fact, we haven't. Closest we come is the cup final.
Well, I do remember the Zenith Data Systems and two FA Cups, obviously two FA Cup finals, but anyway. let's talk about you, Andrew, and let's talk about your life in acting. And am I right in thinking that, you know, you started acting at a fairly young age? I mean, secondary school sort of era? Was that sort of time when you sort of started getting into acting?
Yeah, it was the kind of deluded end to a football, the football dreams. I always call myself a deluded.
We've all had that.
Yeah, deluded. And then always knowing that I kind of didn't want to go and I did my A levels, etc., but I didn't want to go and study something academic at university and impulsively stumbled across drama school at quite a young age, having done just a couple of school plays, not really understanding the whole system of drama school, and impulsively kind of using the did you guys ever have the EMA when you were at college? It's like an education maintenance allowance, which Tony Blair, God bless Tony Blair, bringing in one good thing for me as a college student. I used the EMA money to secretly apply for drama school, and it was like £32 a week. And to get into drama school, it's expensive just for the audition, and never mind to come down to London. So I used the EMA award, £32 a week, to pay for my auditions, and kind of stumbled into drama school on a 3-year course, and didn't realize I got the buzz of acting at school, but I didn't realize the sort of the rabbit hole, so to speak, of actually what that involves and what a sonnet is and what you actually end up doing at drama school. So it was, I enjoyed a couple of school plays, but then that impulse to go to drama school kind of took me by surprise.
And am I right in thinking, like, that you were into Amdram as well? Did you do Amdram?
I did. So in the 1 year I played Fagin at school, I did one play with an amateur dramatic society, and then I was basically at drama school that year at like 17, 18, yeah.
Yeah, because that's interesting, because I always think Amdram's kind of like, it's all, there's that small town kind of thing, and obviously it can be kind of ridiculed a little bit, but actually it's quite a good sort of learning curve doing stuff like that, I think.
It is, yeah. We performed with Guys and Dolls at the Centenary. It was a Centenary theatre company. We performed at the Brinley Theatre in Runcorn. So in those years I was living in Warrington. I think I had youth on my side, because actually the majority of people in the Centenary Theatre Company were 50 plus, which I don't know whether that's a norm with amateur dramatic societies, but it was a beautiful, we'd have tea and biscuits halfway through rehearsals, and these six old ladies would measure me for my costume. And they were the first and only people to ever say I'm 6 foot. I'm actually 5'11", but I still hold on to being 6 foot. I don't think they could measure me properly, but it was an amazing amazing time to kind of just perform in a proper theater, and every, I think we did it for 5 evenings, and every evening go to the theater and just hang out with older people and hear their stories of life and complaining about working for the NHS or whoever they work for.
I've got two questions off the back of that. Like, firstly, one about sort of the idea of sort of turning a love or a hobby or something like that into a job and the changes that comes with. But first of all, I'm going to bring it back to football. Sorry to do this, very on brand for me. But do you think, as you were sort of talking there about getting into acting, do you think... I think this is a completely biased question, and it's loads so loaded. Do you think if you support a football club, I was going to say outside the top six, but maybe any football club, that maybe that gives you the passion, like everything that all those emotions that come out on match day? Do you think football fans are more in tune with their emotions that maybe make it applicable to be a performer?
Do you know what? I'm so glad you went down this route, because I constantly, with a load of my pals who are actors who support, various football teams, I'm constantly making comparisons between the two, and whether that's specific actors and comparing them to specific football players. you know, your Phil Neville's. I'm not going to tell you who I think is Phil Neville, but yeah. Anyway,
tell us off air.
We constantly make, and I agree. It's a. I also feel like having supported Everton has weirdly taught me the sort of no success and learning and dealing with loss on a regular basis has actually taught me to deal with the audition process in a strange way. It has, it really has. And yeah, the passion and that was the same, the emotion I got from like football at a level I played at when I was playing for my county, playing in front of a small audience and feeling like in that moment that like the best games I played was almost where I was imagining I was on the field with my mates back again. And actually the playing element and the worst games I played was where I was very conscious of who was maybe in the stand or who was watching me on that. And that again, I compare to the best footballers. We see the Messies, you know, and some of the young kids who come in before they become aware of the press and et cetera, are still on the field. I remember watching Rooney for the first time. He was literally playing football as though he was in the park with his mates. And I think and that does equate to acting. I think if we do lose the element of play within what we do and it becomes too serious, we become quite stiff and aware of the audience. And that is... I'm glad we delved down the football acting comparison because I'm constantly making it.
God, you're the perfect guest for this podcast.
Can we get that in writing?
Yeah.
Well, it's recorded now. I completely agree, and I'm also wondering something about. It's funny you say about sort of playing at a decent level and that the pressure of who's watching and stuff. I wonder if maybe because football is performance. Isn't it really? I mean, yes, it's a sort of sport and it's like active and stuff, but it is a performance. You are performing for a crowd. Well, you're trying to do your best.
I was going to say, you could also argue that it's entertainment.
Yeah.
But it is. And you're like, everyone's in that shared moment together in the same way that, you know, a theatre audience might be. And nothing beats live entertainment and everyone feeling the same way. And I guess that's obviously in football, you've got two sides, I guess. I guess in theatre you do as well, and good and evil. So I don't know. And also, I'm wondering about the pressure, because obviously, life, you know, performance is a pressure, TV and theatre and stuff. But I wonder if also maybe playing at a decent football level helps you, I guess, channel that in a way.
Hmm. Definitely learn from mistakes as well. Hmm. You know, that as I touched on there, kind of like the worst games I played. Why was it the worst game? And I still do that with acting, you know, finishing a job that I think and starting a new job is always the most important thing for me, because I think it's so important to learn from failure of jobs or not failure or things you just want to do better or things you want to do differently. And that was always me at a football game. And my, you know, bless my dad, he always used to write little notes next to my like shin pads and boots. He never let me clean my boots, my dad, and we still argue about that. He never let me clean my boots, which I wanted to do.
You've got to have clean boots.
Yeah, you have got to have. But, and my dad wanted to, but he wanted to clean them himself.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, he never let me clean my boots. It was like a sort of weird superstition he had. Anyway, it didn't help much, but he'd leave notes next to my boots and my shin pads on a Saturday morning. And kind of tell me, you know, which was kind of like to learn from the last game or whatever, or things to do. And that has been carried through into acting. When I finish a job and start a new job, there's always that thing in the job that I want maybe to try out or to learn from last time. And that, you know, I like to think maybe that's how the best footballers kind of go into games, maybe. I don't know, but that's something I took from football.
Well, continuing the football theme, are you one for doing like a post-match analysis on after a project? Do you reflect on what? Well, I was just thinking, like, you know, because we do that in conversations and stuff. I'm terrible for like having like thinking about conversations I've had and did I say the right thing or whatever. But I wonder, like, when you finish a job, do you reflect on it, or are you just kind of thinking, I'll just go straight into the next one and we'll see how it goes?
There's always a train journey or a plane journey where I'm quite one for notepads, and my missus complains about they're all around the house. But there's definitely me in a notepad on a train or a plane home, where I just take a few minutes and write a few things down. Yeah, there's that, but it's no Monday night football with Gary Neville. It's not that. We don't need Jeff Stelling involved.
He just wasn't focused, Gary. He just wasn't focused on that job. This is Manchester United. I love that so much.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I'm sorry to keep doing. I'm sorry to drag it. I genuinely think there's just so much similarity between two. There's definitely a sketch, isn't there, in like an actor sort of post job press conference, isn't there? Like an actor after a gig or something.
That is a very I'd pay to watch that sketch, definitely.
Yeah. All right, I'll work on it. I'll work on it. I'll ruin it somehow. Don't worry.
But going back to like drama school and going to drama school, and we talked to a few actors about drama school and how, you know, it can be sometimes a baptism of fire, and also maybe you don't always get the necessary kind of information about things like rejection and dealing with, you know, auditions process. I mean, maybe the practical and the logistics of the audition process, but maybe not like kind of the dealing with the kind of the rejection side of stuff. Did you find that when you were at drama school that any of those kind of things were addressed particularly?
There's two things to that. The biggest thing that happened to me at drama school, and with it being quite impulsive, was that I ended up going into the first year without a DADA award, which is like a dance and drama award.
Okay.
So I didn't have one. And myself and my mom, because my dad was quite adamant that I went to do a history degree at Edinburgh Uni, adamant about that. So when I got into drama school, he was baffled by it, as were a lot of my family, asking why am I not, you know, maybe going to teach drama or something. So because it was quite impulsive and I applied kind of last minute, and the one I got into, Oxford School of Drama, I didn't get a dance and drama award. So my first year, I actually thought was going to be my last year, because I didn't think I was actually going to finish it. And it was quite, it was a hard year. I'm not going to lie. It was a hard year because of that. And because I didn't kind of grasp the sort of Shakespeare language world straight away. I didn't know what a sonnet was. I wasn't quite averse with a lot of the people in my cast. There was 14 of us. A lot of people were quite older than me. But at that year, actually looking back and some of the things that happened that year was the biggest kind of baptism of fire to deal with failure and to sort of, you know, confront whether I actually want to do it. And then I just ended up, there was a barbecue in our school. Our school was quite small, run by a guy called George Peck. And he knew that I didn't have a dance and drama award and that I was potentially not going to come back in the second year. And this amazing guy called Ian Persglove came in, who was in charge of kind of handing out dance and drama awards. And I was quite quiet for the whole hour of the barbecue until the very end. Ian Persglove mentioned the EMA award, the Education Maintenance Allowance. And he was like, is anybody in this crowd used, and there was about 20 of us, and I put my hand up and I said, yeah, that's how I got into drama school. And then he came to watch our end of year play, and then he was the person responsible to getting my dance and drama award and for finishing the end of drama school and kind of going on from that feeling of, you know, it could end very quickly and I'm out of my depth to really, yeah, kind of feeling like I'm properly training. And then I guess the second thing with that was my principal himself, George Peck, kind of epitomized, I think, the injustice of the industry in whether he was doing it consciously or not. He basically had a way he wanted people to act and a style of acting that he liked. And it was almost like you either fitted that or not. And I feel like that's a reflection of any room you go into. You can automatically, you know, strike a connection up with somebody. And talent, I think, is it, you know, and having that talent is a byproduct of that room. But ultimately, it's that connection and actually making somebody else want to work with you is kind of what George Peck was like. I was never really his favorite person, but I think I understood working with him that actually maybe I might be so-and-so's director or casting director or even agent or whatever it is, that they might see something in me. And I think I understood that quite quickly at drama school, that you're never going to be everybody's cup of tea, and certain things aren't really going to strike with other people. But it is, you offer up suggestions as a character, and some people take it and some people don't. And George really epitomized that for me at drama school as a principal. Amazing principal, great, very inspirational. But it was this sort of his person that provided the injustice that I then needed after drama school to go into the industry.
I mean, that comes up a lot, I think, on the pod. You know, you can only really be yourself, can't you? And put yourself out there. And whatever line of work you're in, there'll be people that get that and people that don't. And but it's hard. It's, you know, we all want to be liked and want to be loved and appreciated. And it's hard when you can feel it sometimes, can't you, in your bones, when you're not clicking with someone, whether it's in an audition room or in an office, whatever, you can sort of just feel it when it doesn't feel right. And it's a horrible feeling, but I think, you know, it's just part of life. You're never going to be everyone's cup of tea, as you said, which is, you know, such a prescient kind of saying. And I think it's okay just to kind of accept that and roll with that. And maybe once you do that, then you can maybe just kind of progress a bit more. I'm going to quote RuPaul again, which I do most pods, you know. But Mama Ru is never wrong. If you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? I just think that's just never not spot on.
It's true. It's very true. Yeah. Very, very true.
There you go.
And that's me done. Well, it's been great. See ya.
And that's us. That is us. I love myself so much. I'm going to go and make myself a ham sandwich. Yeah.
We've peaked too early. This is the problem. That was an end pod ending, wasn't it, really?
Yeah,
peaked
it was a
25 minutes in. I peaked too early.
But I agree with the sense that, I mean, you know, you do go, you need to think about, ultimately, you want to, as an artist, you want to find your tribe just as much as you want, you know. I know you want people to like you, and you want to be sort of, what's the word, you know, castable on a world basis or throughout the world. But ultimately, I find it now in what I'm doing, and I kind of had that in the back of my head when I left drama school, but it's even more predominant now that I want to find my tribe. I want to find the people who I want to work with. And sometimes if you do enter that room, to think, okay, yeah, you are obviously auditioning me, but also there is a point where I'm thinking, you know, do I want to work with you as well? Because, you know, is that a relationship? We're going to be vulnerable. You're going to want me to, you know, play a character and be open. And it could be for 6 months. It could be for a year. So do I want to give everything to that project with that person at the helm? And yeah, and sometimes it's a good little headspace to have that as an actor, you know. Is this person, you know, are they part of my tribe, as Ben Kingsley calls it? He calls acting like tribal and about it calls it like hunting, but it's like, do you want to be part of that tribe?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I think,
yeah, go on, Jim.
No, you go.
No, I was gonna say, no, I totally agree, and I guess we're all kind of seeking that, and we've sort of talked, I suppose we touched slightly on validation, but I think you're right. I think it's important to know that in most creative situations, if you're collaborating, it's got to be collaboration with the right people that are going to lift you up and be there and support you as well, you know. And I can imagine, particularly like you say, when you're acting, where you are vulnerable and you're taking down layers of your own personality to put in place another being's kind of personality as your character, and you are vulnerable and those, some, I guess, also on a practical level, you're, you know, you might be working long hours and stuff. You do need the right people around you to support you and get the best performance out of you as well, I guess, essentially.
I think that's the most exciting. That's what I've stumbled on in life is the most exciting thing to do with my profession is, you know, basically to get a call or roll over in bed and see that you've got an email of somebody you worked with 4 years ago and they want to work with you again. Mm. And you love that experience 4 years ago. That's the biggest compliment you can have as a human and as I think, you know, an actor as well.
Yeah, because it means you did a good job. Yeah. You did a good job as you. They liked you. They liked your ability and ticking all those boxes. I did have another question from earlier, and I've just remembered it. Just sort of how I do this podcast, forget questions and then remember them at random times. With the training and stuff, was there a moment, I know you said the first year was a bit eye-opening, where you thought, I can't do this, like this is too much for me, I can't do this? And conversely, then, was there a moment, maybe later on, maybe in the same year, or later on down the road in your career, where you were like, I'm fucking smashing this. This is what I'm meant to do and I'm really good at this.
Definitely several moments of the former. We had a small theatre within the school with a large toilet which you could lock. And I definitely remember we were doing Time in the Conways, J.B. Priestley, and I was the only person playing the character all the way through. So I had to play him at several ages. And I just remember being amongst people who, I think the next person to me was like 3 years older, and a lot of them had done NYT and had a lot of experience kind of being natural, I'd say, on stage. And I just remember having a sort of moment where I was like, I was on stage and I just felt very vulnerable, you know, like didn't know what to do with my hands, as what's her name would say, Nina from the Seagull. I didn't know what to do with my hands. And I was literally like, oh God. I went in the toilet and was just like, shit, I can't do this. And then the latter question came quite instantly after, was like a week later when we had our first dress run through. And I don't know, I always think those moments are really interlinked. Like success and failure is I think it fascinates me. It really does fascinate me. And I think and my history teacher at school, when I got into drama school, actually said, and I say this quite a lot, he said, Andrew, good luck at drama school. I hope you succeed, but then again, who is seed? And I was like, what the hell does that mean? Succeed. Playing on the word succeed. He was playing, succeed. I hope you succeed, but then again, too. But actually, now I look back on that. Because he's a very wise guy, I look back on that little message he left, and he's basically saying to me that success doesn't exist. Success is what we put on other people and what we say to other people. We say he's successful, she's successful. We never walk home and think, fucking hell, I'm sick. You don't think you're successful. Success is a projection, and I think he was playing on that because we all feel like a failure. We all feel like a failure, but. So I think my wise history teacher put it on that. But that was the moment I think was very quickly feeling like a failure and feeling like it's all falling apart. And then the week later, after some mad dress rehearsal, where I just decided to play, it all seemed to switch a little bit.
That's you really are the perfect guest for this podcast because that's just
I'm already writing that. So I wrote true. That down, all that stuff.
It's just so true. It's just so true. It is complete projection. And it's so much easier to project it on other people than it is to yourself. Whereas there'll be countless other people looking at you through the same lens.
Exactly.
Saying they're doing this, you know, all this stuff. And it's just that reflection is so hard to apply those rules that you do to other people and to yourself. I don't know if it's just human nature.
Yeah, it's so mad that we always just go, we're on to the next thing, we're moving on to the next thing. So you know, and that's natural because that's an animal instinct, isn't it? To just keep going. So we don't that thing of success, we don't bathe in success, do we? You know, we don't bathe
unless you're a narcissist.
Yeah, exactly. We won't talk about that.
Yeah. It's so true. It's so true. And also, I was thinking like the framing of the word failure, because again, this is something we talk about a lot, but you know, how we see failure in such a negative way. And actually, you know, all the failures often lead to growth in ourselves and also our careers and stuff. And actually, out of every failure, we learn something big about the world, or like I say, about ourselves, and how we need to kind of reframe how we see failure a little bit.
Completely. Yeah. All those, you know, famous quotes like Beatles saying we work best with our backs against the wall, and Bowie saying, you know, about he works best when his feet aren't touching the ground and all that. But they're all hinting at failure. They're all hinting at the no's. And, you know, the Beatles, I was over Christmas again, just like bathing in, I shouldn't use the word bathing in, but I was eating again, Get Back.
Fantastic.
The breakfast and dinner and lunch and all that. It's just, you know, I can't get enough of it. And just watching them talk, they're still going back. You can see within them, they're still harboring on the no's and the people who sort of doubted them, and the Hamburg days when they were rejected. And I think that's sort of so refreshing to see stuff like that, because the no's really do shape who we are, not the yeses. It's the no's that shape where we end up, how we end up behaving, and almost how you deal with those no's is, those no's are, they shape who we are as people, don't they? And it kind of tests yourself as a human.
Yeah, and I think you're often driving away from the no's. I think the no's drive you on more than the yeses. I don't know if it's a British thing where it's like you get a yes or a well done, you're like, oh, stop it, no, it's nothing. And then you get a no and you're like, fuck you, I'm gonna like make this happen. Is that a British thing? I don't know, or just human nature?
Yeah, it isn't. It does sound equate to being very British, doesn't it?
Yeah. That
keep calm and carry on, isn't it? Keep calm and carry on.
Keep calm and carry on. That Beatles doc, was it the scene where Paul McCartney writes, is it Get Back? And he writes it in about 3 minutes.
What's that? Say that again, sorry.
In that Beatles documentary, there's a scene where Paul McCartney writes, he writes Get Back, I think, or one of the songs, in about a minute or something. And you can, he's just like playing around and you can hear it forming. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's insane. He presents Get Back in the room. And he's just, and you know, came to me last night, and then he's playing the riff. But then also the baffling thing of when, you know, I always think they're recording Let It Be in the studio. And it's the recording that we all hear, and it's played in China and all around the world now, and kids are singing. And I always find this mad, like on the top of the piano is Paul McCartney's like third glass of Sauvignon Blanc. and John Lennon is on the floor playing bass, so playing live bass. But he's miming and mocking for Paul McCartney whilst he's playing the bass. And it's just mad that that's the version, that's the dialogue that we have listened to throughout our lives. And that moment he was, you know, three glasses into a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc, and John's on the floor taking the absolute piss out of him.
I love that song. Whereas now it would be like, they'd be like 20 passes at it, and it would be mixed by someone and it wouldn't even sound like them.
Exactly. Completely.
You'd have one of those auto-tuning things on, like Cher.
You had to Let It Be auto-tuned.
Auto-tune Let It Be. Classic.
Like Jason Derulo singing it instead.
Featuring Jason Derulo.
Let It Be featuring Jason Derulo.
Yeah, David Guetta's done a remix.
Yeah, somebody will Photoshop out the Sauvignon Blanc and the cheese toast. Yeah. We can't have that.
Yeah, other wine merchants are available. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's so brilliant that that stuff was all captured as well, though. Just so good that we can now devour it and see. Because, I mean, because I know you play and you're in a band. Mm. I've been playing in bands for many, many years. And being in a studio is really, it's my favorite thing to do these days. Like, I, you know, live stuff's great and all, but you know, you got to lug amps around and stuff, but being in a studio creating something is just my favorite thing.
Oh, it's amazing. And that is exactly the joy you get from the Get Back documentary. Yeah. Is them leaving all the other, because at that point they are, you know, the rumors are going around about them splitting, there's a divide within the camp. And actually, just when they get in that studio, all that, yeah, there's a few things that happens within there, but when they're just playing the music, all the outside bullshit and all the nonsense of the press and stuff just disappears, and they're just four mates again in a studio playing music and taking the mick out of their old music and reminiscing. And yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Giles. Like, the being in a studio, I've only rediscovered that recently. And I hadn't been in a studio since I was like 17, 18. So being back in was like the best 3 weeks I've had of my life. Being in that studio was recently was, yeah. So I completely agree with you. It's amazing.
Did you go in, did you have a bunch of material already written? Or did you do stuff, some writing in the studio as well?
Predominantly, so I'd worked with Craig Potter, who from Elbow, on a little indie film, and then we presented some music to him, some tracks of ours that he'd stumbled across on like online, and then we started making some home demos with him, which was really exciting. Like waking up at 1 a.m. and because Craig works quite late.
Yeah, all sound engineers and producers do that. Ridiculous.
Ears are better.
Yeah.
Get rid of all the sound noise from outside.
I've never met a sound engineer that's not like mixing something at like 2 a.m.
It yeah. is really, so I'd like roll out of bed and just be like really excited in the other room on this our little Sonos speaker playing stuff really quietly and hearing it and whether we like it. So yeah, that was the process. We came up with the four tracks for the EP with him, worked on the home demos, and then we had 3 weeks in Blueprint Studios in Manchester, which was just, again, just forgot about the outside world. And
yeah, it's the best. Just
had fun session musicians coming in and choirs coming in. And yeah, just incredible, incredible.
Yeah, it's nothing like it.
Sorry.
I'm desperate to get back in the studio with my band this year. We haven't done it for a couple of years. And I found some old pictures of us from the last time we were in there. And
nice.
Just me tracking like guitars and stuff, and it's just love it. Like, just love it so much. Just sitting there in the control room tracking guitars for hours.
the hours do just disappear.
Oh man, totally. You lose date. Honestly, yeah, they just go. You think, oh, we've only been here for 5 minutes and you've been there for like 10 hours. And you've done I've only like done tracked two guitars or something. I thought, oh gosh, there's quite a few to go yet.
But there's definitely something in there about sort of being in the moment, isn't there? And I was going to bring it back to football again, but it, you know, like the world is full of madness and we're all anxious people and there's all things in our minds, but when you're then in the moment, either in the studio or you're out on the football pitch or whatever, something where you have to be in the moment, you have to concentrate on the thing you're doing. Or it could be, I know people have part like painting, stuff like that, where you have to be in the moment. That, I think we all need these things to take us away from the madness of what goes on outside. Otherwise you just go mad, don't you?
And to have like a collective in the moment experience. Yeah. That's why I love theatre. Phones are off, hopefully, they should be. They should be, and then we're all in the moment together. And to do that with, like, yeah, you know, four of your mates and or however many are in the band or a football team or whatever, yeah, you to be in that moment and forget about the outside anxieties. Yeah, I completely agree. It's where the point we all want to be at, really, isn't it? We want to find that moment, I think.
Yeah, it's magic. It's magic. It's where magic happens, I think. Yeah. Have you always been musical then?
So my play, like, I've always, we had a musical house, like granddad, and tradition of sort of, you know, every Gower get together, there's a load of us, and there'll be Sinatra and Andy Williams and Nat King Cole and people getting up and singing, whether the rest of the people in the pub want to hear you.
Love it.
There's that within our family. And kind of like weird rumors that go around saying that my granddad was nearly offered a record deal and all this stuff. But no, I think that's just nonsense. That he gigged with Ken Dodd.
Well, who didn't? I mean, if he was confirmed long enough.
Ken Dodd's dog's dad's dead or whatever. So that was going around. So it was a musical house, and my brothers, I've got the two older brothers, you know, a massive music. They just love their music, love it. Nothing, they don't work in music at all, but just love their music. So, yeah. And then me getting into singing kind of came from doing a couple of musicals and then stumbling into a band before drama school. And we had some relative like good times with that band. But then when I went to drama school and did acting, I left it all behind, but always kept up songwriting. So I've always, like, I don't play really at all very well on guitar or piano, just enough for chords, but my predominant like writing of music has always happened. And then myself and my Norwegian mate from school, Webbo, who's our guitarist for Gustafsson, we've stayed in touch for years, and we got back into it recently, and then back in the studio just last year. And so I've always done it, but there's been gaps in between where I've just carried on writing lyrics and not actually performing.
Webbo is such a football nickname.
Webbo. Webbo is really his football nickname. Yeah, Webbo. Webbo on the right wing. doesn't track his fullback back. Definitely. Lazy. Always thinking about going forward, Webbo.
Classic Webbo.
Yeah. He gets his guitar out at the game, after the game.
Yeah.
He brought that with him.
I totally get that. Like, music's like that for me, actually. Like, I could never not do it. But, like, I'm not always, you know, we go months without, like, getting in a room and writing together or anything. But I would be so depressed if I didn't have it in my life somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my guitar is next to me here. Like, if there's a moment where I'm, like, feeling a bit, I just grab it, play a few riffs, put it back on the wall, and I feel better already. So I think, like, to not have it would be really, it would really depress me to not have it in my life. So even, like you say, even if you're not like kind of doing it all the time, just to have it sort of rumbling along in the background, if you're just writing or like lyrics or coming up with melodies or whatever it might be, it's just,
I think that distance is quite good as well. You're talking about have a bit of distance from it is quite nice as well, because I mean, it's interesting thinking about having done the EP, thinking about doing an album. It's like we've got a lot of stuff, but some bands do get to a point where they make the first album, and I call TV series sometimes the second album, because people, you know, the second album is the difficult album because you've used all your material you've been working on for ages to make your album, and then to actually have to sit down and write new music with a timeline for a band is quite a difficult task. Yeah. And for it to have like deadlines and stuff attached. So it's nice to have a bit of distance and to let things happen in your life, or to hear a story and write about that rather than having the deadline of doing it consistently.
Yeah, I totally get that. I remember back in the early noughties, I was in a much more successful band than I'm in now. But yeah, there was that kind of, when we had a like management, and there's that pressure to like get stuff out to A&R and all that sort of stuff. Oh, we need more stuff. We need new material. And so you're in the studio all the time, and it does reflect on the material. You're not producing as good stuff. There might be the odd bit that's like, but you know, and you see that with bands, you know, when they're like fifth, sixth album that they've done in successive years comes out, and you're like, it's not quite as good.
And they're like, can you just do that, you know, can you do that thing you did with the first
album? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That, you know, that upbeat song.
Yeah.
Why is your music so sad?
Because I'm sad, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, because I've had to be in the studio every fucking year for that.
rather unprofessionally, I've got to go in 5 minutes because I've got a meeting. I've started a full-time job recently, which is very un-me, but got a meeting in 5 minutes, but I want to ask you two questions. Firstly, I want to know who the Phil Neville of acting is. And I know you can't tell us on air, but maybe you can tell me off air.
Off air, you'll get the Phil Neville of acting, yeah.
Secondly, I'm just like, you've been in some massive shows and Midsommar Murders.
Yeah.
Come on. Just it's a class. Everyone's got to be in Midsommar Murders. It's classic. Is there anything you want to be in?
Is there anything I want to be in? I think going back to why I got it, I think I want to be in more things that are from where I'm from, you know, that speak about where I'm from. I want to see more dramas on TV that reflect like working class people who are intellectual, because they are. You know, I look back at like Naked by Mike Leigh.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
Hewison. Like he was a man who was fighting where he's from, but ultimately the way he speaks is eloquent, and there's that. And yeah, and I think, again, to go back to my other point, is just to find more. There's nothing I really want to be in apart from if it's with people who I want to kind of be part of their tribe. That kind of thing where you trust them and they trust you, and they, you know, and the script in the Bible is brilliant. But yeah, definitely stuff from where I'm from and intellectual Northerners, but mainly just more people who I want to add to that list of my small tribe.
would you write that?
Would I write?
If that sort of project wasn't, you know, developed.
I definitely would. And I'm always... I mean, I have a little production company that we've started, and we're always looking for, you know, scripts, and we have a couple of scripts that we're out pitching. But definitely, yeah, that is just, it's just really important, because, you know, I'm not saying a lot of stuff that comes on TV isn't really pivotal to what people need to hear about, you know, but there is a lot of it that I do see a depiction of the victim and the murderer and it's, you know, and that's always been the case, but I think there's a real big opportunity for, you know, for somebody to show a different side of, you know, of that coin, basically.
There's a few tropes in TV, I think, aren't there, that people sort of fall into, and
we unfortunately live with tropes, don't we? We all live with tropes. It's a trope world.
It's a tropey world. I've got to go. I'm so sorry. It's
really interesting. Andrew, thank you so much.
Andrew Gower on the Blank podcast. What a top bloke, who is more deserving of the intro we gave him and this outro we're probably about to give him as well. But just what a lovely guy. So easy to talk to. Some lovely stuff about his career so far, and lots that I could apply football analogies to, which is always also good as well. But yeah, just a lovely, lovely guy, and fantastic actor as well. So really enjoyed his company. Apologies again to him and to our listeners that I had to cut it short a little bit, because it felt very unfair. And maybe we could do a part two with him. We know we talk a lot about, don't we, about getting people on. I think if anyone's going to be top of our list for a part two, it would be Andrew. Maybe in person at some point.
We need to do some in-person ones. It was great. It was really lovely talking to him. And I think, like, straight off the bat, we were talking about, we got into talking about football. And it wasn't necessarily us like pushing that narrative.
Well, we throw the bone out there, and we throw the boomerang out. We see what happens. You could tell straight away if someone wants to talk about football or not. And of course, my eyes light up.
Yeah,
like a striker is through on goal, and I then can't help myself. But there were nice points later on in the pod where actually I was like, oh, actually, that what he's talking about there are actually. And with someone who is into football, actually, I can do this little analogy. I think it will work and stuff. But I think when someone's on your wavelength and it comes to a passion like that.
Yeah, they're always crossovers. I think they're always crossovers with these things. I think creativity and sport there are lots of crossovers. I mean, there's lots of disciplines and things that, you know, and passions, obviously, that cross over with two things like that. So, yeah, they're always going to be. And I think with regards to, like, acting as well, when you're part of a lot of creative pursuits are collaborations, they're team efforts, you know, even if you're, like, writing a book or if you're in a band, obviously, in a band, that's a team, you know, you've all got your positions. I'm doing football analogies on the... on the football analogies, but it's true, like, you know, so it's fair. I think it's fair comparison sometimes, so it's all good.
I feel vindicated. Wait till we get next week's guest and I'll start ramming home football analogies and they don't care.
The ironic thing is, when we have people that are actually associated with football on, we don't talk about football at all.
We should actually, we should do some tweets about last week's guest, which was, of course, Martin O'Neill.
Oh, we've got so many correspondence about that one.
Yes, this one's really resonated. And obviously, a football icon, really, 50 years in the game. And it was an absolute joy talking to him. I don't really feel like we had to say much because he's just such a good speaker. He just, you know, we'd give him a little few breadcrumbs and he'd spin a whole story, multiple stories out of it, which is great. The highlight for me was him admitting that Steve Claridge shinned it in.
Well, we've actually got a tweet about that, and it says Lee. It's from Lee Ayres, and he says, "I still need Claridge to admit it."
Lee is a big Palace fan and a follower of my other pod, and I'm wondering if now we try and get Steve Claridge on blank, and just yes, so we can get him to admit that he shinned it in 96.
We've got one question for you, Steve. And then you can go.
We'll start where everyone wants us to, at the obvious. Because I think Claridge tried to say it wasn't a shinner. Anyway, sorry, I am again.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Doing football chat. But yeah, we've had lots of really lovely correspondence from the Martin O'Neill episode.
Yeah, lots of I guess, fans of teams he's managed. He's obviously in a lot of people's hearts. Quite a few on Instagram as well. Lots of people sort of big heart, love hearts and stuff, and blue hearts, because obviously a lot of Leicester fans coming out. He's obviously very much still very fond of by the Leicester fans. We did a lot of good stuff there. And I've got a Villa fan friend, Scott. So if Scott's listening to this, if he's got through to the end of the podcast and still listening.
Scott's not listening.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell him to, because he's a Villa fan. And I remember telling them we were getting Martin O'Neill on. He was very excited about it.
So it's obviously still listen to all the way an hour into this.
Yeah, Scott, you've got to listen all the way till.
Don't tell him where he's mentioned.
No, you've got to. It's nearer the end, but it could be near the beginning.
Anyway, thank you to everyone. I can see Margaret Payne on Twitter.
Yes,
said great manager, loved his time at Leicester. Like, that's really resonated as well. So thanks to.
It was a great episode
for coming on. Christopher Burke as well, just on Twitter. Just had a listen. Top tier guest you got. Listening to the anecdotes of his career is a good prelude to reading the book. There you go. If we've helped with one sale, the book, then we've done our
then we've underfulfilled our obligations.
And an apology to our patrons. I am really sleep deprived. I scheduled the Martin O'Neill pod for the wrong Monday, so it went up a few days late. Catherine for pointing that out on Twitter, so I apologise.
No worries.
This one hopefully has gone up on the right day, but who knows?
Yeah, so always apologies if we sort of diddle you out of your...
Because our patrons are supposed to get it early basically, yeah. But they got it 4 days late.
However, they did get extra content, so that they still did get something extra. It's not that I'm not sorry, I'm just saying, you know.
Anyway, if you want to get pods 4 days late, join our patrons. patreon.com/blankpodcast and extra content.
You will get extra
including
content
this week with
Andrew. And you do get ad-free content, and you will get it most weeks when Jim's on the ball a day early.
Who knows, this week maybe it'd be a day early, maybe it'd be a month late, who knows. That's just the
or at all.
I've got to go to bed in a bit, I think. So I think I heard my daughter crying, so I think
you're back on duty.
Anyway, thank you to Andrew for coming on. What a top bloke. And let's hope Everton Did they sack their manager? I think they sacked their manager after we recorded. Or was it before? Can't remember.
No, it was our...
Anyway.
We talked about a new manager that was coming in, but I don't know if that's been confirmed yet.
Oh, but that's... It's Sean Dyche, but that hasn't been... Has it been announced? I'm not sure.
I don't think it's been announced.
Anyway, that's one to talk about with Andrew about. Giles, good to see you. I'll see you next week. This is a shambles. I'm so sorry. I'll be better slept, hopefully, next week.
Yeah. Take it easy,
with another
dude.
Great guest. Thanks, man. With another great guest in the Blank Podcast. So it just leaves... And you can do the sign off. It just leaves us to say.
Well, there's only one thing to say. Don't get cancelled.
Bye.
Media Podcast.